Eleanor and Roger Fenn are being interviewed by Renee Garalick for Concord's Oral History Program, sponsored by the Concord Historical Commission. The interview is taking place at their home on 25 Church Green on February 14, 1977. Eleanor will be 80 and Roger 82. Roger, are the similarities or differences in Concord life more apparent from when you arrived in 1915?
That is very hard to say. The new dam is about the same in appearance as it always used to be, and the people are just about as anxious as ever to keep the old flavor of the historic town as it always was. An example of this is obvious when a wealthy individual from the Middle West moved into town and proposed, after he became quite at home in town, that he should be allowed to replace all the ancient buildings along our main street, which we call the Mill Dam, and make the town look newly built, but in the style of the colonial period. Perhaps it might be like another Williamsburg in Concord. And the old people in town, especially along the Mill Dam, just would have nothing of it. They wanted the old town to stay the way it always had been. They even went so far as to protest against the introduction of gas in the town of Concord by the Boston Company, which wanted to supply the gas for the town in heating the houses and cooking food. One man had a store on Mill Dam, and he also owned a residence on a nearby street where the food was all cooked over a kerosene stove. Now, those people have been accustomed to a little better stove in their kitchen than a kerosene stove in the 1930s. And this man, the owner of the house, protested against the introduction of gas in spite of their urgent request, because he said, no, we won't have any gas in this house. If you put gas in here, you'll wake up some morning and find yourself electrocuted. You find the same feeling in the people of the town now. New people move in from the cities because they like the flavor of Concord, they like the historic atmosphere, and just as soon as they get here, they settle down into it. And then when somebody wants to make a change, they're the first ones to protest against any change.
How would you describe your teaching life at the Middlesex School, particularly the student-teacher relationship?
Well, the teacher-pupil relationship was very informal, friendly, very easy, natural. We were very much like an enlarged family. The teachers were practically all men, and the students were all boys. So it was like an older boy or uncle enjoying himself with the younger boys who were the students. We would live in the same dormitory together with 25 students. There would be one married man with his family at one end of the building, and one unmarried man with his room among the students, all taking cold showers in the morning together before breakfast, and going to bed by 10 o'clock at the latest in the evening, except the man, the teacher, who often had to stay up quite a lot later. The boys used to like to play pranks on the teachers. They were not vicious pranks, such as you read about in the old days of rugby, Tom Brown's school days, but they were ingenious. I recall thinking of staying up until after 10 to do our work in the evening, noting that when midnight came along, the school clock on the top of the school building struck 13. Now this was quite unusual, and I thought I had miscounted. But I asked some of the other men the next day after coffee period after lunch if they had noticed that it struck 13, and one or two of them did. So the next night we all listened again, carefully. A lot of us listened. And again it struck 13 at midnight. Well, this required an investigation. And the investigation soon disclosed the fact that the bell showed a mark, a spot, on one side of it. Several spots close together on one side of it. They were all on the same side. And they were all on the side toward the third story window in the boys' end of the dormitory. So this suggested an investigation of that boy's room while he was out of class, and disclosed the fact that he had a rifle in his room, hidden away, with a Maxim silencer on it, so that he could pull the trigger just at the time the last stroke of 12 had ceased to vibrate. And that kind of thing was going on between the masters and the boys. It required a certain amount of punishment, but the punishment was always done in a kind of a friendly way. To illustrate that, I could report that my dormitory was right next to the school building, connected to it by a boardwalk, and after supper every night, the boys went to their studies to prepare their homework, and there were five or six boys of the older groups who had their studies right in the end of my dormitory toward the school building. So as I came from the school building shortly after supper, when the boys were supposed to be in their studies, I would pass along the boardwalk into the building through the hall in the common room where their studies all were. And I was very pleased and proud of my dormitory because the boys were always quietly studying in their rooms, whereas other men were reporting that they were having trouble keeping the boys in their rooms during the study period. Well, it didn't cause any concern on my part until one day, walking across there by daylight, I just happened to notice, because I'm an observant scientist by nature, a small electric wire coming from the window of one of the boys' studies down to the ground. I followed it along the ground close to the building to where it went under the boardwalk, and along under the boardwalk to a point where it terminated with a metal plaque about 6 inches square lying on the ground. And just above that plaque, nailed to the underside of the boardwalk, was another plaque of metal, which didn't, these two plaques did not touch, because the boardwalk was warped at that spot. There was a little area between the two. But when I walked across the boardwalk and put pressure on it, the two plaques touched each other. And then I and my assistant housemaster investigated the situation. He went inside the building where the boys' rooms were, and I stepped on the boardwalk at that place, and a buzzer sounded in the hall outside their bedroom of their studies. The result was, of course, when the boys were out in the hall having a rough house, when they heard the buzzer ring, they knew I was coming, and all my boys were quietly in their studies, studying in quotation marks, when I came in. Well, I had placed on the ground between the two plaques a cardboard which said on it in good big letters, April Fool. And I left that between the two plaques of metal. The next day when they were all roughhousing in the hall outside their studies, the buzzer did not ring because I insulated it. And I came right into the midst of the howling mob. Well, they all went into their studies. I said nothing, but tried to scowl without smiling and went along through my room. They got the point. So the relations between the students and the men were very friendly, and we could have our punishments when they were necessary, but the thing was usually done in the right good spirit.
I went to Middlesex a good deal before Mr. Fenn because the daughter of the headmaster was my best friend, and I used to come out and spend weekends here, and it was very good fun. Middlesex tried to be a good neighbor in the town and tried not to do things that would disturb the neighbors. And Mr. Windsor, the headmaster, said to the boys and to his family, it's not the thing usually in Concord to play tennis on Sunday. At least it hasn't been. But I can see nothing wrong with playing tennis on Sunday. And if you said to your story, if you girls want to play while the boys are in chapel, you may do so, but play on the courts that are not near the road, because I would not like to have the neighbors go by and be shocked by seeing you play tennis on Sunday. Mr. Windsor was a very fine educator. We were very lucky to get our apprenticeship under him, because he was a true educator, and he believed in letting the masters educate themselves as well as the boys. You were told what to do in your course, what you were expected to accomplish in the year, and then you were mostly urged and left to do it in your fashion, so that you had the bare bones and you could enrich them according to your own education and the broadness of your own view, which was a very fine way to learn to teach, and something that we tried to carry on at Fenn School as best we could.
Your legacy to Concord is the Fenn School. Will you describe the circumstances surrounding its creation and what the early days were like?
Yes, I can give you a little booklet which has just been published by the school, containing some of my reminiscences along just that line. And if all I can do here is to give a little resume of what I said, what I wrote in that booklet for the benefit of the alumni. It was an alumni bulletin going around to them. I had been teaching for the better part of 14 years, taking out something close to 2 years for the World War I, at Middlesex School, and getting my experience, early experience there, and felt that I was ready and anxious to be running a school of my own. And this piece of property appeared, 5.5 acres on Monument Street in Concord, which looked like a suitable site for an elementary school. So we bought it, only investigating the situation for one weekend, and started then in September of 1928 to prepare the school to open in September of 1929. All the work had to be done of preparing this place while I was still teaching science classes at Middlesex and being the interim business manager of the school at the same time, because the business manager was out for the most of the year. We got an architect, a promising young man who had a good deal of experience and skill at producing colonial architecture, William F. Cusick. He designed the building, which we wanted ultimately to start as a school, by renovating the farmer's house and the stable behind his house, big enough to hold one horse, with hay over his head, and you know what underneath the stable, in the cellar, with chicken houses around it, and a one-horse farm. We also had to get together the people who were going to be our board of trustees, because this was not a proprietary school, it was going to be an institution, not-for-profit, run by a board of trustees, and therefore tax-exempt, and a dignified institution. We also had to get a number of people in Concord who would be willing to send the boys to the school. There were public schools in Concord, of course, and they were being used all the time. But there were not the opportunities for the younger boy, which was the age that appealed to me more than the older boy, the opportunities which a private school could afford and a public school could not. Those opportunities were included, such as the presence of an all-man faculty, practically all men on the faculty, men who would want to have friendly relations with the boys as well as high standards for the boys, men who could coach them in the athletics in the afternoon and teach them the group games, which the high school boys always had in Concord, but the younger grammar school boys could never get. We wanted to put it in from the lower grades of our school and give the boy an introduction to these group games for his own good and character building and sportsmanship and make him a better athlete when he got to the high school level. Also, we were very anxious to have small classes where the teacher could have close, friendly, easy relations with the students and adjust the teaching to each student according to that student's needs. You cannot do that in a big class, most of which were containing maybe 30 boys in the public schools. That's too many for one man to give much individual attention to every student. Well, the idea then was to renovate this farmhouse so that we had a few classrooms, each large enough to contain an ideal number of 10 or 12 boys. We put them around a table in the room, sitting on individual chairs, not benches, around the table, where they could have a discussion with the teacher rather than have the teacher stand up in front and teach, propound a few principles, and have them hopefully remember some of it. We want give and take between the student and the teacher. We want the student to work out in his own mind the answers to questions which would naturally come to him in each subject that was being taught, to get his own education. And our principle was going to be that he was not a tank and gasoline tank in an automobile which could simply be filled up by the teacher making a speech to him, but he had to come to school to get his own education. It was up to him to do the studying, to do the thinking, and to learn how to prepare lessons at home in the evening. It was much the same situation for the schoolboy as it was for the adult in Concord in 1775, when he left his plow and stood up on the bridge down at the Concord River and faced the British troops in order, and was willing to fight the British army in order to have the privilege and the opportunity to run his own government as a free citizen. Running his government was squarely up to him as his responsibility. And so in our school, getting an education was up to the boy to get his own education. And we took the motto, sua sponte, with that meaning, writing it underneath the statue of the Minuteman on the bridge for our emblem. Sua sponte was the Latin phrase for on his own responsibility.
Your first academic year began in 1929, and the Depression hit soon after.
Oh yes, and that was quite a surprise. We had thought that there was that the time was ripe for a school, and that there were people who would be willing to pay $400 a year for tuition at the school for day students. And we opened with 53 boys as students, with high hopes that things were going to go smoothly. We had, all through our years, about one-third of our students as day boys from Concord, and one-third as day boys commuting from neighboring towns. And after the first few years, we had one-third as boarding students. They were paying as much as $1,250 for the board for 7 days a week, and lodging and tuition. Well, everything went very smoothly for the first two or three weeks, and we were very happy with the situation. But in early October, the stock market crashed as it had never crashed before, and the big depression was on us after only 3 weeks of what you might call prosperity. We never knew what a serious situation it was. We were so involved and so busy running the school and enjoying ourselves and teaching the youngsters that we just took it all as in our stride. And we went along through the year wondering how we were going to come out financially. The trustees did a lot more wondering than we did, but the parents were, as they always have been, extremely loyal to us and understood the situation that we were in perfectly well. They understood more about it than we did, I guess. Because when graduation came around on the early day in June 1930, the end of our first year, trustees all gathered for the graduation exercises, and several of them eased themselves up close to me and nudged me in those ribs at the side and said under their breaths, "How much are we going to have to chip in to get you through the summer financially?" And I had the pleasure of telling them, "Nothing at all. You don't chip in a thing. We had a budget at the beginning of the year. We stuck to the budget all through the year. The parents have paid their tuition bills very promptly and faithfully, and we're going to be in the black all summer long."
The social circle in Concord is unique in its members' involvement in town affairs, and the published biographies of deceased members have become a source of town history unto themselves. Will you tell us about Concord's social circle?
Yes, it's it is a group which was the outgrowth of the old Committee of Public Safety in the Revolutionary War days. It was started in 1782 and was composed largely of the influential men in the town who had been the leaders in the revolutionary movement in the town here. They met on Tuesday evenings every 2 weeks through most of the academic year in order to accomplish two purposes according to their constitution. One was to strengthen their affections, and second was to disseminate useful information among the members of the social circle. It was a very informal organization. There was only one officer, the secretary treasurer. The chairman of it, or president of it, was simply the host for the evening's dinner. Each 2 weeks the host changed, and the host was the chairman for that evening. They had refreshments served at 6 o'clock in the evening. Then that was followed by the dinner and the dissemination of the useful information in talk, almost always about town affairs, after the dinner was over, and the circle was to close at 9 o'clock in the evening. It has been remarkably steady, repeating the same routine ever since 1782 when it started. There still are 25 members, and there still are men who are residents of Concord, and still men who are, for the most part, very active because of their love for the town in the government of the town, members of committees, all of all sorts, can be found in the social circle. It has no actual influence in town affairs. It takes no part as such in the town government, but with most of its members active on committees, it is a very useful organization to have to keep the town running smoothly with a homogeneous government. The practice was started somewhere about the middle of the 19th century of writing a memoir about each member of the circle who had died. Shortly after his death, some member of the circle is appointed, and the custom still prevails, to write the memoir of the deceased. Those have been published in 6 volumes in the last 100 years. So that we now have the 6 volumes of memoirs of the people who were in the circle. These have been carefully preserved by the circle, and they have been placed in the Concord Free Public Library and are constantly being referred to by historians, professional or amateur, who are interested in delving into the history of the town. They do give a personal, intimate picture of those particular men who were influential figures in many, many cases in the town history.
Let us remember the ladies, Eleanor. What did you think of the all-male social circle?
Well, my first introduction was soon after Roger was elected, when I think the wives of all the members, whenever they, the first time they saw me after the election, would come up and say how glad they were that Roger was a member. I hadn't known much about the social circle before, nor had he. And this kind of cordiality was very nice. And the women don't come to the meetings at all, but we are supposed to put on a good dinner. And it's rather fun to do it when you can devote yourself entirely to the cooking and not have to be a hostess beside. Though usually after the dinner is over, mostly the men that you know it all well stick their heads in the kitchen door and thank you for a very nice meal. For sure, it was a much more elaborate meal before we ever came on the scene. It used to be a sit-down meal with three courses, and everything was very, very elaborate in the way it was done in the last century. Now it's far simpler, and people don't sit down. The houses aren't big enough to seat 25 people, and you have to have a stand-up meal. Back in, about 100 years ago, the wives of the social circle decided they didn't especially care to be left alone every other Tuesday evening, so they set up the Ladies Tuesday Club. And Mrs. Orford and Miss Ellen Emerson and various people like that were in it. And it's always been, I think, a fun group to be a member of. It's much bigger now. They're not all wives of members of the social circle, nor are all the wives of the social circle in it. But it's a group of women of varying ages, and we get together about five or six times a year, maybe for lunch, maybe for a Valentine tea, maybe for dessert and coffee and music or slides or something like that in the evening. And once in a while, really the most fun, when we sort of go back a bit and get together and act charades or play old-fashioned games. And I can remember some of the older ladies like Mrs. Stedman Buttrick and Mrs. Robb. They were my age when I came into the club. I can remember them having a great time acting charades and taking us back a good many years, which was lots of fun. Other things that women have done in the town, of course, have always been a lot of the social service and charitable kinds of things, working at Emerson Hospital, working for the different rummage sales, things of that sort. They have also taken part, always on the school committee, and they've gone to be much more numerous on the other committees now. I think I was the first woman member of the finance committee, and my invitation to be on that was not too flattering. The then president of the League of Women Voters and Mr. John Kennedy and other people had been pestering the moderator at that time, Mr. Wardwell, to put a woman on the finance committee, and he didn't think that was proper at all. He believed that that wasn't where women belonged, but they pestered him so much that finally he decided he had to do it, and I guess I seemed as harmless a woman as he could think of. I had been president of the League of Women Voters and been interested in things in town. So one Sunday night I got back from a weekend at an educational conference and the telephone rang. Mr. Wardle said, "You've been away." I said, "Yes, I was sorry. I hope he hadn't been trying to get me." "Yes, will you be on the finance committee?" And I practically dropped the telephone and he said, I said, "Well, I feel honored and very surprised. And yes, I would be glad to." He said, "Well, they've been after me. They made me do it." And that was our telephone conversation. I think this happened in the late 40s. My next surprise was perhaps telling my family what I'd done, and they said, "What, Mother, you can't even balance your checkbook." And I said, "Well, I figured that the other people on the finance committee would do the figuring that they wanted, what the town's reaction was to the Finance Committee's actions, and I could probably give them that because I've always been pretty active in the town. I had been in on the founding of the League of Women Voters back in about 1930. Miss Goodwin, who was the retired headmistress of Milton Academy Girls School, and some of the other women in town felt that Concord needed or would enjoy having a League of Women Voters. And it was a lively group that started it. Women had more leisure then, I guess, than they do now, or at least they weren't taking so many jobs and so on. And then most of us still had cooks and maids to help out and the things that had to be done in the house. But anyway, they set up the League of Women Voters, and it got the reputation, and I think the reputation was deserved then, of being a group of intellectuals who really probed into things. You didn't go and try to work on all the issues that were coming up in an election as you do now, or go to town meeting well prepared, but you specialize in some one thing. It might be fiscal policy, it might be foreign relations, it might be county government, some one special thing, and you really delved into that. And when we had meetings where we reported on what we've been studying, they really had to know a lot to begin to speak in it. I think it's now come to be much more relaxed in one way, much more general, much more used to everyone. When you go to their meetings before town meeting and discuss the town warrant, or when you discuss something like the Equal Rights Amendment or the gun control, it's not a philosophic PhD proposition. It's something practical, useful to everybody, and the idea is to get as much information as you can out to all the voters and not just to a select group and for one committee. We were thinking also about things that women did in town, and everybody did in town, like in World War II. We were on rationing then. At the school, of course, we gave a lot of meals, and we had to take the ration books of the boys who boarded there, who had the majority of their meals there, and we had to hand in the ration books to the ration board, and then they issued us a book of checks, just like checks for money, and you there were red coupons and blue coupons, and one was for sugar, and one was for fats and oils and meat. And you had to, when you ordered from the grocer so much beef, you had to pay so many coupons, just as if you, just as you had to pay so many dollars. And the bank coped with that. You deposited your checks once a month in the bank, and then blue check on it as if it were money. And the checks you got were, each month were based on the amount of that kind of purchase that you had made in the month before. And it was all very complicated to set up, but it worked fairly smoothly. We also were rationed for gas quite strictly. And you didn't go anywhere for pleasure. You went where you had to go. Also, there was a lot of recycling then. One of the masters at school was in charge of it. For the whole town, the boys used to collect tons of scrap paper and scrap metal and take them down to the old high school, which doesn't exist anymore, and bale them there and send out tons from the town. And also, of course, the women took a lot of part in making clothes for the refugees and the bundles for Britain, and making bandages and things for the Red Cross. So they were interesting places to work because everybody of all sorts and all ages came. Some of the older ladies who were in their 80s and were marvelous seamstresses were sort of in charge of it, and somebody would come in, a young woman who practically didn't know a pin from a needle, and she'd sit beside one of these 80-year-olds and she'd learn how to make really beautiful clothes. They'd be turning out little boys' jackets and things that were just expert out of a couple of years we did it. And we also had a canteen company, which we used to to serve at Devon's and places like that, and we always were at the station every time the draftees went off. They went off in the train at 7 o'clock in the morning up to Devon's, and the camping company was always there. And Mrs. Julian Ballou, whom some of you may know or may have heard of, used to come bicycling down the hill, down from the shore of the hill, and with hot donuts, which she had gotten up at 5 o'clock in the morning to make and give them hot and fresh to the men as they went off to Devon's. Another thing that everyone took part in was watching for hostile airplanes. The airplanes fought on the top of the shore of the hill. First it was up in the attic of Mrs. Brooks's house, which was the highest house in the hill, and then they built their own tower. The men from Fenn School used to take over shifts from 12 to 2 in the morning, 3 or 4 times a week. And the routine was that the man who was there before you, half an hour before you were due there, called you up and woke you up, and then you went up and took his place, and then half an hour before you were going to come off the view, called up the next man. And Mr. Fenn was very much interested in astronomy. It used to be a great place to exercise astronomy. And he used to call up the man who came after him and said, "Oh, what a beautiful night. The sky is just effulgent." And this was one of the very practical bankers in town, which was a sign of his life that didn't show a proper accept in World War II. I guess that's about it for that.
What about the Girl Scout?
Oh, yes. I what the Girl Scout troops did and the captains, you can get far better than people like Mr. Chamberlain, who were among the early captains. But I used to be on a committee at the time the Scout House was built, or not built, remodeled. The Girl Scouts had been quite active for a number of years in town, and we decided that it was time they had a meeting place. The schools had been great about, and the churches too, about lending us space for the Scout troops that we had, but we thought they needed a house of their own. And the big barn, of course, there, which was the barn, the farm that was there, was not being used except by somebody who kept a few chickens in the yard, and we decided we could buy that farm, which belonged, I guess, to the First Parish at the time, rather cheaply, and it would be better, much better to buy it than to have it torn down. The same architect who built the Fenn School was engaged to make it over into the Scout House, and he had great fun really maximizing the features that he could save, the old hand-hewn beams and the cupola and all of that, and he made a beautiful job out of it. We had to go out and raise the money. Mrs. Russell Robb offered to give us, I believe I'm correct in saying, $2,500 if we could raise $2,500. It may have been $5,000, matched to get $5,000. And that was going to be enough to make over that big building into what it is now. Prices in the Depression were not what they are now. And we thought, well, we certainly could raise that money, we'd go out and do it. The first people to approach were the mothers of the Scouts, and get them to approach their neighbors for small contributions. 50 cents, a dollar, $10 was going to be a lot to get, if we got enough people, that would match Mrs. Robb's offer. I was a young bride then, and I went to Mrs. McCone. She must have been I guess she was Peanut McCullough, the sport shop's mother. And she had one daughter who was a very active scout and the oldest in the family, and then she had 6 sons back down in the spring. And I didn't have any more sense than to think that, well, anybody could see anybody at 9:30 on a Monday morning, but Mrs. McCullough could. Her house was spotless. Her line was full of white shirts for Mr. McCullough and 6 boys. And I asked her if she'd be willing to solicit people on Lang Street. And she said, yes, I'd be glad to. Anna gets a great deal out of the Scouts. I'm all for it. I think the Scout House would be fine. And you know, my youngest is in first grade this year, and I really have a lot of time on my hands. And I made a resolution then that I would never think I was busy if Mrs. McComb wasn't busy at 9:30 on the Monday morning. I guess that's fine. I have a very good memory for dates, but I think this all happened in the late 1920s.
Thank you.